Okay, we're good.
Thank you, David.
Okay, everyone, thank you for your patience. Welcome to the June meeting of CRC. Let's do a quick round of introductions. Let's just do these. Kristen Malone.
I'm Hillary Houck.
That's David.
Everyone, happy to staff.
Would like to move the internal affairs.
Signing of Mr. Turner, Abel.
Philip Lowell.
Irene Jordan.
Signing of Mr. Turner, Adrian.
I'm Matt.
And I'm reporting cop watching plan for this video director, and I'm hoping that maybe we can just have an informal conversation once the formal meeting is over, so that as long as we've been kind of coming out.
Regina Hannon, reporting cop watch.
Carol Fisher, League of Women Voters.
Nicholas Livingston, Chief Forest Security.
Julie Fox, oh sorry.
Amanda Lamb, IPR.
Julie Fox, CRC.
Dana Ford.
Okay. I thought Dan was pointing like I missed somebody. Thank you, everybody, for being here. Amanda, do you want to do the director's report and then straight into the annual report?
Sure. How much time do I have?
Well, Neil has 30 to 45 minutes.
Okay. So the director's report, the first issue on the director's report is I have been appointed the interim director of IPR. This isn't in print, but I just kind of want to give a little bit of information, a little bit of my background. I started my career as a performance auditor, and then I went and did criminal justice research at the county before joining the auditor's office about a year and a half ago. I started in the auditor's office in IPR as one of their management analysts before moving to the chief deputy's role. And with the departure of our long-serving director, Constantine Severe, and two of our assistant directors, the auditor, Maryhill Caballero, has appointed me to serve as interim director while we recruit replacements for our leadership team. The second thing on the director's report is that the Department of Justice is in town right now. If some of us look a little tired, it's because it's been a long week of meetings. Very fruitful meetings, though. We've been discussing quite a few things, but specifically related to Section 8 of the settlement agreement around officer accountability. We've really tried to drill down on what's driving overages over the 180-day time frame that they've set out in the settlement agreement. We've identified strategies to address those drivers, and we are looking to achieve substantial compliance on the settlement agreement.
Can you share a little bit about what the drivers have shown to be?
Yeah, so I can tell you a little bit more about our process because the process, I think, is the more important part. So basically what we've done is we've pulled the cases that have gone over. Some of them have gone substantially over. Some of them have not been as substantially over. And we've looked at each data point in those cases to try to figure out which stage they went over in. So was it the intake process? Was it the investigation process? Was it PRB? Was it appeals? Was it some other kind of review? And then once we figure that out, we look within that stage to find out what's driving that overage. For example, a lot of the cases went over on the investigation stage. So we looked at then what is the nature of the case itself? Was the investigation just incredibly complicated? Was it a staffing shortage at the time? Were people kind of overextended and weren't able to devote the time to that that particular case? Was it delayed because there was a concurrent criminal investigation going on and we had to wait to get information? That kind of thing. So that's the approach that we're using. And in general, specifically, the solutions, the strategies that we're using to address the drivers are addressing the drivers that we actually have control over. So when we have to put out requests for information and it takes a while to get information, we don't have a ton of control over that. We do have control over, for example, managing our own workload, making sure that people are only assigned a certain number of cases at a time. If they're currently working on an investigation, they shouldn't be assigned another investigation. That's just an example. So that's been our approach. Does that help?
Yes, super helpful.
Great.
Thank you.
Any other questions? All right. I'm not going to spend a lot of time talking about the annual report because I'm going to do that right after I'm done with this. But we released the annual report for 2018 in April. It is available on our website. We do have a couple of copies here. I will also note that we are reprinting some copies. There were a few tweaks we want to make that I'll get into in the report itself. So we're going to have fresh copies soon in the next couple of weeks. I also wanted to provide a quick update on the director replacement recruitment. As I said, I am serving as interim director. So how do we get somebody to fill this spot as quickly as possible? Prior to becoming the interim director, I was actually assigned this as a project in my chief deputy role. And the approach that we took was we wanted to engage internal and external stakeholders as much as possible while also moving the process through pretty quickly so that we can get somebody on board fast. So before the job announcement ever went out, we met with quite a few folks to help us build what we called the candidate profile. So the candidate those meetings led to creation of a candidate profile, and that candidate profile helped inform both the job announcement and the interview questions that we're going to use throughout the process. In the job announcement itself, for example, the announcement included, in addition to minimum qualifications and the things you see on every job announcement, it also included quite a bit of text and qualifications around leadership, oversight and accountability, community engagement, and a focus on diversity, equity, and inclusion. Those are all things that are really important to the person that's going to be filling this role, and we wanted to make that very clear in the announcement as well. Those interviews have also, the interviews with the internal and external stakeholders have also already begun to inform the questions we'll be asking each of the candidates. On that note, the interview process is underway now. We're going to be doing two rounds of interviews. The second round of interviews are going to be taking place later this month, and they will be a bit more extensive of a process than we typically do for recruitment. We'll have three separate panels. One of the panels will be IPR staff. One of the panels will be what we're calling our internal stakeholders, which is the Portland Police Bureau and the Police Commissioner's Office. And the third panel will be comprised of community members. And I provided a short list of the community members that we've invited to that panel with the caveat that not everybody may be available. We may have to swap some folks out. But what we're hoping to have is we're hoping to have representatives from the Citizen Review Committee, the Portland Committee on Community Engaged Policing, PCEP, Oregon Center for Public Policy, and a past IPR complainant. So hoping to have a pretty representative group there. There are a few other folks that we are hoping to get on that panel as well. Those interviews will help inform the one-on-one final interviews that will be done directly with the city auditor. So it's a pretty extensive process. We're hoping that the process itself will be wrapped up this month. And then the decision made shortly thereafter, and then it's a matter of time, hopefully. So, the community outreach piece, this might be the piece that I read, because I don't want to get it wrong. IPR Senior Outreach Coordinator Irene Kornev made a presentation on the IPR commendation and complaint process to the Southeast Public Safety Committee and the Muslim Advisory Council meeting. She attended REACH Luncheon, Oregon Association of Minority Entrepreneurs Trade Fair and Navigating Network event at Portland Community College. And she's also been a big help. And we've engaged all of IPR staff in the director recruitment process as well. Irene in particular has been a big help in connecting by phone, in person, and email with a series of groups and organizations and individuals across the city, including Friends of Children, Slavic Advisory Council, Muslim Advisory Council, the Urban League, APANO, ERCO. You can see the list goes on. So we've leaned heavily on her expertise to help us with our community engagement effort as part of this recruitment process. The IPR investigators, Vince Elmore and Eric Berry, have also attended outreach events and recruited at the Interfaith Peace and Action Collaborative meeting. And finally, a CRC community dialogue in collaboration with Portland State University Law Enforcement Contacts Police and Data Committee. The CRC held a community dialogue on police crowd control practice at Portland State University on April 10th, and IPR staff attended and supported that dialogue. Now, question for the group. How do you usually go through the numbers in the director's report? Is there anything in particular you'd want me to highlight?
I can't remember the last time. I think they did send it last year. It's been a little while.
Okay.
Can I ask before we move on, just how IPR is managing with the loss of so much staff and institutional knowledge so quickly.
Yeah.
It seems probably like something DOJ has
It's a completely reasonable question, yes. So I have taken on Constantine's workload. I am fully in the role as interim IPR director. I am not serving as chief deputy right now, so I'm working out of the IPR offices. I've taken on his caseload, so I've taken on the director's role. For the assistant directors, we have the city auditors actually appointed our city ombudsman and our office's general counsel in the roles of assistant IPR director. So they're doing most of the work that Rachel and Anika used to do. They're reviewing cases. They're adding their input on investigations and so on. So we are managing the caseload. Luckily, we're fully staffed in our investigators, and also luckily we have a lot of institutional knowledge that remains in our organization, so we're leaning very heavily on lead investigator Barry. We're leaning very heavily on our analytics team right now. It's kind of an all-hands-on-deck moment, but we are so far managing quite well. We've also continued our collaborations with internal affairs. And so we're continuing to meet regularly with our partners internally and externally, and the workload is being managed. The other thing that I would say is, while change is always difficult, and it's certainly a challenging time, and I don't want to understate that, it's also, I think, a good opportunity to sort of reassess what we've been doing and how we've been doing it. I think the Department of Justice being in town is also a good opportunity to do that. So we have a lot of fresh eyes on the processes and the practices that we've been using, and I think that has actually been quite helpful. So, you know, while it's a challenging time, I think it's also an opportunity, so we're trying to look at it that way as well.
Can I just ask who from the CRC participated in the kind of initial stakeholder meetings about the IPR director? How was that done?
Yeah, so they were just one-on-one interviews, and I met with Kristen, or term alone.
So just Kristen?
Yep.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay, my guess is that there are going to be other questions, some from this group, some from the public, about the IPR report, which we use this as an opportunity to do Q&A. So if you want to give like a high-level overview and then we can jump into questions.
I can do that. I've prepared a little outline here. I was planning on going over the report, kind of my takeaways from it. I don't want to go over it in too much detail. I've also got my computer here not to be distracted, but because I want to be able to pull up the dashboards that we have that support the report, in case you have questions that I can answer immediately. Otherwise, I'll just record them here and try to get you the answers when I can. So are we ready to launch in? Okay.
Do it.
All right. So right off the bat, I want to talk a little bit at a high level. The purpose of the annual report is to highlight IPR activities over the last year. And I say that because it helps us scope the report a little bit. We're reporting on what IPR has done or what complaints that originated in IPR have gone through. It's not intended to talk about the criminal justice system as a whole. We're not reporting on a lot of things that are firmly in the Portland Police Bureau's lane. It's also intended to be approachable to the general public, so it's not exhaustive, in other words. And it's not intended to be, and we're trying to create something that is, like I said, approachable to the general public. It's easily digested, more for the casual reader. I already mentioned, I am going to have these dashboards up in case you guys have very specific questions. The dashboards are where we intend to allow the user to really drill down into the data and answer very specific questions that they might have, or questions that we didn't even think to answer. So they're supposed to be more dynamic, whereas the annual report is supposed to be a little bit higher level. So the highlights from this year, I think one of the big takeaways is that we've received more complaints from both the community and Bureau members, and we'll get into that a little bit more. There were also seven deadly force incidents in the past year, which is more than there have been in previous years. We also have an officer-involved shooting and deadly force dashboard that I'd encourage you to look at. It has more information than exists in our than we have here in our annual report, and again, it allows you to be to engage with the data a little bit more dynamically, drill down on certain things that you want to know more about, look at specific years, look over time, etc. So there have been a couple of changes to the accountability system this year that is that have affected our work. The first being that we can now do supervisory investigations, which are done where there was a minor rule violation alleged, nothing that would exceed command counseling if discipline were imposed. And the second is that IPR and IA investigators are now recommending findings that go to the officer supervisor for review. In future reports, that change was implemented in about July of 2018. So we didn't have enough data at this time to say what the result, like to look at the aggregate and see what the results of those supervisory investigations were. But we intend to do that for next year's report, and we're starting to look at that now as we're able to collect more data. Internally, we hired some additional staff. We released additional policy reviews. We created these dashboards that I'm going to keep pointing to throughout this presentation. And we've continued to expand our outreach efforts. I'm going to skip the how the system works section of the annual report because I think I'm speaking to a group that knows pretty well how the system works. The only thing that I would highlight is I think the graphic does a good job of explaining how IPR fits into the process, the graphic on page 4 here, and then the flowchart also highlights how CRC fits into the process. I also want to gloss over a bit the complaint process itself. Again, I think we're all fairly familiar with the complaint process here. I will note that complaints from both the community and the bureau members did go up in 2019, and we don't know precisely why that is. We did do some digging, particularly into the bureau member complaints, because it about doubled, which is a pretty significant increase. From what we can tell is we are getting complaints from smaller units that haven't typically submitted a lot of complaints in the past, but we're not entirely sure what's behind that increase. I would also note that you can look at the complaints received on the complaints dashboard. We have a complaints dashboard and we have an allegations dashboard. Tab 1 of the complaints dashboard and tab 2 of the allegations dashboard both look at what has been coming into our office. Who's submitting complaints? I find this to be one of the more impactful sections of the report, and also the one I like to proceed with the most caution on. One of the issues that we've run into for quite a few years now is a lack of data around complainant demographics because people don't provide that data. We're working internally on strategies to improve that, but as of right now, we have about 35% of our complainants without demographic information, so there's a lot that we would like to look at that we can't necessarily look at. But what I will say is the trend continues where Black community members are more represented in our complainant population than in the general population. And white and Latinx people are underrepresented in our complaint population. So I think that's an important metric that we will continue to look at.
I would also like to add that it's been, I think, 3, maybe 4 years since we had an appeal from a Black complainant. Maybe 2. But I think that the vast majority of people who make it to this stage in the process are white people. So I'm just wanted to bring that to your attention too. Maybe that's something to look at beyond just the complaints, but also what happens after they're filed.
I will make a note of that. In the dashboards, you can engage with that data a little bit more. So I think, I don't want to misstate it here. I believe it's in the allegations dashboard that you can drill down by complainant demographics to see what kind of allegations different populations of the community tend to submit to our office. So that's kind of one way we've looked at it. There might be a few other ways to slice and dice, but I don't have that right here. So that's an important note as well. All right, one of the other things that we noted in this report is that community members submitted complaints against 376 officers, which is more officers than in 2017, and 45 officers were named in 3 or more complaints in 2018. So as far as what happens to the complaints once they come into our office, the administrative closure rate for IPR continues to drop. It was at 73% in 2014 and it's at 56% in 2018. The most common reason for an administrative closure is because there was no misconduct that was alleged. There are additional closure reasons on tab 3 of the complaints dashboard, and on that you can also drill down by complainant demographics, so you can see based on, depending on the population that you're looking at, you can see how complaints are resolved, whether or not they're dismissed. Yeah.
I'm sorry, on page 10, community members submitted complaints about 376 officers. Over half of those 376 were named in one complaint.
So there was just one complaint against them.
Oh, and the other half had more than one.
Yes, yes.
Got it, sorry. Apologies.
No, it's okay. No, it was a good question. No, clarification questions are welcome. Yes, thank you. I also wanted to point out on tab 5 of the allegations dashboard, you can also look at the closure rate by allegation type. On the allegations themselves, the most common allegation types were for procedure and conduct. That was the same as last year. The allegations dashboard also shows trends by allegation type. I think you can look at the different trends by allegation type. One interesting trend that pops out to me is there's been a decrease in force allegations over the past 2 years since 2016. There's a lot of stability in allegations related to disparate treatment. Those are just numbers. They don't tell you why any of those things are, but they're interesting trends. Inadequate action and/or assistance continues to be the most common allegation, the same as in 2017. Bureau members were also there's a difference between the most common allegations for bureau members versus the complaints we received from the community. And bureau members were more likely to submit complaints about unprofessional conduct. In the allegations dashboard, you can also use the interactive filters on the side to filter by either bureau member submitted complaint or community member submitted complaint, so you can drill down that way as well. On independent investigations, we completed 25 independent investigations in 2018. Most of them were related to disparate treatment, or the greatest majority were related to disparate treatment, 9 out of the 25. But we continued to also take a look at a lot of protest cases and investigations with captain at the captain level or above. The types of allegations we investigated are also in the allegations dashboard in the fourth tab. Follow along with myself here. We refer about 20% of the community member complaints to the internal affairs for review. They also initiated complaints themselves, and so they reviewed a total of 133 community member complaints. They investigated 68% of those complaints and sent another 22% for SIO. You can also look at in our complaints dashboard, you can look at IA intake decisions there as well. And most of the complaints were not sustained, exonerated, or unfounded. Only 10% of the community member complaints were sustained, which is less than in 2017.
Amanda, what page are you on? Sorry,
15? 15. Tab 6 of the allegations dashboard also includes findings for all allegation types, and you can filter by the allegation type, you can filter by precinct or the unit, and you can also filter by case type, as I mentioned, being bureau or community member initiated. Police bureau members also filed 77 complaints in 2018, which is about twice as many as in 2017, as I mentioned. 65 of those were investigated, and 55 were investigated by internal affairs and the rest by our office. 49% of those allegations were sustained. For citizen review cases, this is...
Quickly. The Bureau employees, do you know what percentage of them were officers?
I'm sorry?
Were they all officers, the Bureau employees?
I don't know.
You talking about for the B cases?
Yeah.
No, I don't believe there were a lot of sworn.
We don't differentiate between sworn and unsworn, right?
Yeah, just anecdotally speaking, I'm pretty sure that there was a representation of the rank officer.
Would you mind just speaking up as an introvert to hear you again?
Yeah. No, what I said was that anecdotally speaking, I believe that that the internal the B cases that we call were represented throughout the ranks and not just at the rank of officer.
Any other questions, sir? For the citizen review cases, this is one area where I said we needed to make some tweaks and reprint. This is one of the areas where there is a mistake in the current iteration of this report. We hope to have this corrected by the end of next week. The current version incorrectly references one of the cases twice, and both as a case with some findings challenged and one where pending a council hearing. And it also neglects to include another case. So there are some reprints that we need to do in this section. For the officer discipline section, out of 39 officers with sustained allegations in 2018, 20 received command counseling. That's the majority of the discipline. And one officer was terminated for misconduct. Those were my highlights. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Okay, for the interpreter again, which might be inclined to terminate.
One.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Any questions?
I have a question, but I'm not sure if it takes us off the report a little bit. It may or may not, so if it does too much, then we can defer the question. But I think it was the last meeting we had, a CRC member asked, you know, why do you think, asked at the, I guess more and more, why do you think that we haven't been having this many appeals lately? And, you know, I see here there was 5 last year, you know, and I'm remembering, you know, years before. Early years on the CRC when we were doing 2 a month, and so it really has been a decline. And I felt like there wasn't a very sufficient answer given to that question, and I just wondered if you were seeing trends in the number of appeals that the CRC was hearing, and what might explain what I think it feels like we're on target to be pretty low this year as well.
It's been really slow. Mm-hmm.
This is the third month in a row.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there was a time, there was a focus group formed by city council to figure out what we were going to do about the CRC, because we were hearing 2 appeals a month, and people were burning out. People were, you know, it was a really dire situation, and now it's, you know.
People are quitting because they're getting bored.
That's not happening. So it is like a really steep drop off.
Yeah. Okay. I don't have any information on that right now. I can make a note. It's an interesting question.
I mean, I think that the response we got was an optimistic one. Like, you know, oh, people must be satisfied with their. But I don't know that we have the evidence to support that. If we do, that's great, and it would be great to see that. But I'm concerned it could be the opposite. That actually maybe people are dissatisfied with you know, how they hear that appeals are being handled. And so I'm really curious to know more if we can find out more information.
It seems like the drop-off sort of coincided a bit with the supervisory, the addition of the supervisory dismissals, but I don't know whether that's a real thing. That was July.
Right, the last year was low.
Right, last year it was started in July.
Yeah.
And I remember the beginning of last year being pretty busy. But maybe, I mean, that is like completely anecdotal. Because I don't
know. Because it's so late in the process that, like, the appeals that we get are from things that happened a year ago. So if the supervisor.
Oh, that's true. Yeah.
Anyway,
there also
questions.
Probably haven't been a sufficient number of supervisory investigations, or at least not from July to December, to really drive that kind of trend. I do always say, I'm known for saying, that the data will tell you what is happening, but it will not tell you why. So I don't have the why in front of me, and I wouldn't want to speculate. But.
I think because I don't know if I'm speaking for everyone, but I'd like to know more about why, if it's possible to find that out through other people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I think if anything, my total speculation is that this, I feel like in 2014, 2015, 2016, there were a lot of community activists, people who were watching the police, who were testing the system, you know, trying to see what would happen, what would we do. I remember hearing that a lot. You know, is this a process that works? Is this a process we can trust? And I feel like, in part, that might have culminated a little bit in the first appeal you took to city council with the taser appeal, that personally I think the result was very, very wrong in that case. But I feel like, you know, I wonder if that kind of period of testing the system and seeing what really happened resulted in kind of a sense that this is not going anywhere.
Or maybe the testing was sort of instantiated in more appeals coming before us, and this is the actual baseline. It's not getting as many appeals.
Anyway,
yes.
They know, because they've emailed, that there are some members of the public that have questions about the report, and because we're on a tight time clock, I would like to open it up to public questions, if that's okay with you.
I think that's your decision, Jim.
Okay. Let's check in. Neil, how much time do you have?
12 minutes.
Okay, let's do 12 minutes of public questions. Okay.
I would like to ask a question after the public,
but I'll defer to the public. Okay. Questions?
I kind of just have a follow-up off of what you're wondering about. Oh, maybe I don't know the women voters. About what you're asking about why the appeals have dropped out. Something I raised with the COCL when I sent in comments on the quarterly report was that IPR used to do like a satisfaction survey among people who use the system. So then you could ask those kind of questions. And so I've been kind of pushing the COCL to lean on the IPR and start doing that again. And he said, he checked with the IPR and they said, well, they were trying to ask questions again, but people weren't really answering them, and so they decided to give up. But I just wonder since it would be nice to know the why on some of these things, if the IPR might, you know, put some more effort into thinking about how to get feedback from the people who use the system. So, I'll put a question mark at the end of that, even though it wasn't really one.
And I'll add, from my perspective, for, you know, new thoughts at IPR, that feels to me like a subset of the bigger question that I think IPR should really focus on tackling, which is how best to communicate with people who are using the system. And we've heard a lot about people who get things mailed to them with a 14-day deadline, and they're just not in the habit of checking their postal mail, but if you had called them or if you emailed them, they would have hopped to, or, you know, trying to figure out ways to get that feedback. You know, there are people who work all day, maybe an investigator calls during the day and leaves a message and is, you know, it just doesn't work. But if you could send an online survey or something where they can just think about different ways to access and contact people who are engaging with the system, because I think we hear a lot about how difficult it's been for people to connect.
Can I sort of follow up on that too? Like, I've seen letters that were mailed to appellants that included, that said, you know, you have the opportunity to appeal this decision on or before, and then just a period. So they're not even getting the very tight appeal window. They're not even, the date for that is not included in the letter that they're getting. So even if you get the letter and you pick up the mail and I can give you the name of the appellant that I saw this in, but I've also interviewed other appellants who didn't receive the letters, contacted Director Sevier, were told that the letter was mailed. Maybe you're just not kind of responsible about your mail. And so I think that the mailing to appellants system is something that is not working. And I think that it's, you know, it seems like it could easily work if it were a priority.
I think that's important feedback, and I appreciate that. I think we can always do a better job of engaging with both the people who use our system and the people who don't use our system right now. And so I've made notes. I appreciate that. It is on our radar. It's something that is included in the plan, in the strategic plans that we have to do a better job of reaching out to our community, to the community, and specifically to the folks who engage with our system. So I think more to come on that.
Comment here. Hi, I'm Philip. Thank you for the response here. I really appreciate the details, and I look forward to reading more about the report and your findings. One thing that came up while we were talking was the community's complaints, how that increased, whereas the internal bureau complaints also increased. So I'm wondering why both have increased. I would think that one would dip down and the other one would dip down. Both are increasing. So any thoughts on that?
It's a good question. If we knew the answer to that question, I think we would.
I just believe that if we knew the answer, that would give us, maybe shed some more light on something that needs to be addressed. Because if we don't know, then how are we going to improve? How are we going to address the situation? Both complaints are increasing. So there's something going on there.
I will say, with respect to the community member complaints, that it was an increase from 396 to 415, so it's not a substantial increase, and it's been volatile over the last couple years, but it tends to hover right around that 400 complaints per year mark, so not a substantial increase. The increase in the Bureau member complaints was fairly substantial. Doubling is a large increase. And so, which is why our analysts did dive into that data to try to figure out if we could identify what the drivers were based on the information we had. And really the only conclusion we were able to draw is we were getting complaints from units within the Bureau that we don't usually get complaints from. So I don't have the numbers right in front of me, but what I take that to mean is kind of the areas of the Bureau that typically complain have maintained fairly steady numbers. It's more we've added other units or divisions. That's what's written in the report. I don't have more details on that right now, but I do think it's an interesting
question.
Thank you.
I was just
wondering. Dan Hamill, with Important Cop Watch. I have two quick comments and two questions. For one thing, the mistake about CRCs that was found by our group the second year in a row, where IPR mistakenly reported on what their appeals were about. So just wanted to make that point. And perhaps there may be more appeals after the City Council finally substantiated an appeal that you brought to them. So we'll see what happens with that for me. So the first question is, will IPR, but more importantly, I think, if not, will CRC support CompWatch's request for the data tables that are used to generate the report to be printed either in the report or online, because the dashboard is constantly updated. So we're trying to dig through, and you know, I have a fundamental disagreement about this being just for a casual reader, because there are people around the country who need to know this information, in other agencies and other police departments, and they should be looking at this too. But in order to find out whether these data match up with what the IPR is saying, I go online, and the numbers have changed between the time that they wrote the report at the time that I could look. So, and they used to always publish those data tables in the report, and then 2 years ago they published them as an appendix. So would CRC be supportive of asking for those data, and would IPR be willing to publish and post those data?
If I went on the dashboard and limited my time scale to 2018, it would be the data that's included in this report, would it not?
Mostly match. We use the dashboard as an opportunity to improve the quality of our data. So when we find mistakes or when data is updated, the updated data is included in the dashboard, and this is a snapshot. So some of those data haven't been updated yet. There might be some errors that we are able to catch when we do. We update the dashboards quarterly, so we're able to catch some things. So off by a handful, a small, like one or two typically.
I mean, it seems that you would, wouldn't you rather have the accurate data than the data that went into the static report?
No, because it's very confusing when you go to the dashboard and you do the numbers and it doesn't match what's written in the report. So if the report is a static thing, so it'd be good to have those numbers somewhere so you can see how those were, even if the next year you say we changed this since last year, footnote, so it's not the same number. Like, I can show you even several examples where the percentage has changed because of, even if it was a small number of cases, the percentage has changed. So if you put last year's report and this report next to each other, they don't match, which is very confusing for even a casual reader article. So you see what I mean? It's just important to have that snapshot of the data published somewhere so we can find out what the numbers were at the time of the culture.
But it seems like that's only useful for catching IPR out in a mistake.
Yeah.
But it's not really helpful for knowing what's happening.
It's to make sure that it's accurate. It's so you understand what the percentages mean.
But what's accurate is what's been updated. That's the accurate number.
I understand. Well, except that I'm walking away with this report and I'm not the person going to the dashboard, right? So I don't have the accurate number because I have this report, this printed report that's sitting on the shelf in my office. And so what do these numbers mean in this report?
I just think it's more likely that people in other cities are accessing the report online rather than
But the report isn't being updated when the dashboards are updated, or are they?
Yeah.
So you don't have anything that matches. You can't dig into this data if you don't have the data to dig into. And it doesn't exist anywhere because it changes.
That's what I'm trying to say.
I think that.
All right. Well, you can discuss it further.
Okay.
Is there any particular reason that the IPR doesn't want to publish those tables?
Honestly, the primary reason is workload. It is labor intensive to put together all of the tables that go into this report and publish it as a separate document. We also think it's important to understand the difference between the static document and the dynamic data dashboards. They do serve slightly different purposes. As I said, this is a snapshot in time, and it's intended to be a snapshot in time. As somebody who's done data analysis for many years now, every snapshot report will contain some things you wish you could go back and correct. That's just a reality that we have to deal with. And when, you know, we're assigning, when we're applying our resources in different areas, I would rather apply my resources to make sure that these dashboards are accurate and that the public has access to the data behind the dashboards rather than going back and updating the report every time we catch a small error.
Well, that leads to another question before I ask another time. So my second question is IPR going to present this report to council? And if so, are you going to ask the mayor about public testimony at that level?
We do not intend to present to council.
Is there a reason for this?
We don't see a reason to. If they have questions about it, they can return to us. If they want to request a presentation, they can do that.
Mr. Handelman, in the interest of time, I just want to make sure that if somebody else has a question that they want to get in before Mr. Simon has to sign off, we have to adjourn that they get it in. If not, I'll just keep going. But just want to make sure that everybody gets their shot.
I mean, Neil had a question. That's
Neil has a
most
question.
Important.
I'll still defer to public if there are other questions.
I think the only person with remaining questions is Mr. Handelman.
In that case, I'll proceed. I forgive me if you mentioned before and I missed it, but thank you to the interim director for stepping in and her leadership in this interim period. I wanted to ask about the hiring for the director's role and how many candidates there are and the state of the interview process and any impact that can be seen at this stage of both the DOJ relationship with the city of Portland as well as the state of play of sort of police oversight in Portland and whether it's been it had any impact on recruitment for this role.
Whether or not the DOJ settlement had any impact on recruitment?
Yeah.
You know, I don't know if I would be able to answer that question. Certainly nobody contacted me and said I'm not applying because of the settlement agreement. We had quite a few candidates. We had more than 60 candidates submit an application, which is more than is typical for the other director recruitments that I've worked on at the city auditor's office. We're interviewing less than 10 candidates in the first round, and we hope to have 3 to 5 candidates go on to the second round. First round interviews are happening over the next couple of weeks. Does that answer all your questions?
Yeah, I appreciate that.
Okay.
Are you also interviewing for the assistant director position?
We are not right now. So one of the things that we wanted the director to be able to do was to hire the assistant director
when they got it. That makes sense.
Yeah.
I just had a question following up on the numbers of complaints. I know I've read a lot about how the city is losing officers and it's unable to recruit more officers. I assume, although I don't know, that that's resulted in a lower number of officer contacts with the public. It seems to be remarkable that as we're losing officers and having less of a presence, that our complaint levels are remaining the same and going up. Is there any analysis that can be done or has been done on complaints per capita, complaints per contact? If you had 100 officers and you had 100 complaints, and then the next year you had 10 officers and you had 100 complaints, that would be remarkable.
Yeah.
Even though it looks steady.
Yeah, those are really good questions. We haven't. It would be a pretty robust analysis to do to try to tie particular contacts to complaints, because people can complain about interactions with officers that weren't contacts necessarily. An officer parking in the wrong spot, for example, that was not a contact, but that is a complaint that we get. Trying to do that kind of one-to-one relationship is really analytically very challenging. So we haven't done that. We did do complaints per capita, so complaints per officer. We have it broken down on page 9 of the report. It's broken down by precinct. We did a similar breakdown last year. I don't want to take up your time while I search the dashboard, but I believe in the dashboard you can also look. I think it's in the complaints dashboard at the complaints per officer.
Are there actually
compared to last year, it's able to kind of track over time?
I believe so.
Are there actually less officers this year than last? Is that true?
I believe that, and I don't know, because like the dashboard, we are constantly inserting officers and officers are retired.
Give me a snapshot.
I believe that we are approximately 125 or 130 positions down right now, and that's the last number I heard. That was a little bit ago, and so that may have changed. I am not sure.
But you don't know whether we're more down than we were last year at this time?
I don't.
Okay.
I don't know the answer to that.
I know we've been down for quite some time.
And the other thing that I'm not sure of is whether or not the number of citizen contacts, the documented citizen contacts we had, fell last year. Because sometimes even with less officers, that number doesn't necessarily change. And so it can have because the logic is, to me, is appropriate that with less officers, you're likely to have less complaints. But if the number of citizen contacts don't fall, then there's the potential that number holds steady. So I can try and get that information for you before the next time.
It seems to me. The number of hours that an officer is likely to work will change based on how many officers are on the beat, right? So it seems officer hours would be the better proportional number.
I can say with confidence, because I've worked on this a lot, we've tried different ways of slicing and dicing this particular data to try to figure out the best comparator. The overall number of contacts, the total number of officers, officer hours, we've looked at a lot of that. A lot of those relationships are just really difficult. And they're not, we don't have that data internally either, so it's stuff we have to request. So it gets a little complicated. I think they're really good questions, though. And I don't know that the dashboard does answer them, so I stand corrected. Could I just make one comment on one of Mr. Handelman's comments? He did point out the mistake on the CRC data. I would just like to acknowledge that we see that as a weakness in our current data collection practices. That is not the CRC and the PRB, or the Police Review Board decisions, are not included, not in our database. And so we're not able to track them electronically. We're working on getting a new data system, and we hope to be able to have a better tracking mechanism for those decisions and those processes so that we can do better reporting on them. And
we do appreciate you pointing out the mistake.
Thank you. Neil has hung up.
It's true.
We are adjourned.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, everybody, for coming.